I think Tenny's going to join us at least part of the time. And so actually, I think what I'd like to do is to let us, so the rhythm of this of today is going to be like this. We'll sit for a few minutes to just let a couple more people gather. And then I'm going to talk some, history and the kind of flow of the Dharma as I see it coming through ancestors, a kind of a bird's eye view. And then we will sit some more. And then I will bring in the con exchanges that I sent out to you last night, if you got those. And I'll bring them in anyway, if you didn't. And then take those into meditation and have some conversation. So we'll be in and out, back and forth a little bit. So let me give us a little bit of meditation. Thank you. So as I've been participating in the open source series that's currently going along, visiting with our ancestors in the Zen way, I've been struck again by that saying that has been presented to describe Zen for such a very long time, direct transmission outside the scriptures. And feeling curious about some aspects of that sort of then and now, and realizing, for one thing, that's what we're doing here, is we, even on a screen, we are directly encountering each other, each other's minds, each other's lives, each other's houses even, or images. And that's not besides the point. The direct encounter that we have with each other, with our hearts and minds and our lives as they are in this time, this is it. This is what we do. And I'm so happy to be doing it with you today. From a distant, but in another sense, no more distant than usual. So two quotes, one of which I sent to you, have been also hanging out with me through this. And one of them is that the one I sent is, "Unmeasured space is the Lord's habitation." That expression, "unmeasured space," really captured my imagination, because I just had this instant, yes, unmeasured. It's, you know, we talk about the vastness, we talk about the large. And when we talk about emptiness, we think of it as very large, I think. And yet, unmeasured space has nothing to do with large or small. It has to do with not measuring. It has to do with a space that is as yet undivided in any way. And I think when we talk about emptiness, that's more what I think we're talking about, is the undividedness, the unmeasuredness of time and space. That is fundamental to what's real. And so the second quote comes from the Vimalakirti Sutra, then says, "An undivided mind is the pure land." An undivided mind is the pure land. What is your mind like when it's undivided? So we'll sit with that in a little bit. But just, I wanted those to be sort of in present with us as I talk a little bit about this sort of wander through the beginnings of our tradition. So very earliest, you know, in our Zen tradition are the teachings about what we call Prajnaparamita. And I love the way Red Pine describes it. He says, the teaching of Prajnaparamita points to our mind before we learn how to divide the indivisible. Prajnaparamita points to our mind, yours and mine, before we learn how to divide the indivisible. So I found myself asking, and so that's in the Heart Sutra, it's in the Diamond Sutra, and so here we are doing this special encounter outside the scriptures, but I'm going to talk about scriptures for a little while, and we'll be outside of them and inside of them. So I was asking myself, okay, where do I find in myself the problem for which this is the solution, right? If Prajnaparamita is the solution, what's the problem? And what I noticed was that, like, lately, I've been dogged, well, lately, like, you know, for a couple of years anyway, I've been dogged by the weirdness of the oscillation in my own life between the delicious ease of being alive, you know, just the beauty of simply being alive right now, the sky each day, what's growing, what's happening on the ground, what's at the horizon, what's in the lives of people and my own body, which is, after all, quite a community already, only less than half of which is human. And the ins and outs of my days, what's the weirdness of the oscillation between the delicious ease of that, just this, just being this, and the so at any given moment, I can touch that, right? It's delicious to be alive, no matter what's going on. And then the agony of feeling utterly squashed by the number of critical problems at all levels for which there's no apparent solution. What is this wobbly walk? You know, what about, is that the problem that for which Prajnaparamita pointing to our mind before we learn how to divide the indivisible is the solution? So I noticed two kinds of divisions in my experience that I'm talking about. And one is that the kind of division that I make between the awareness of unmeasured space. So the awareness of unmeasured space. I can touch it right now. It's just here. But how do I divide that from immersion in the particulars? You know, the washing machine quits in the middle of the cycle. You know, the wind is coming up. Will we be okay paddling out there? Am I strong enough? You know, all the little particulars, you know. What's at the farmer's market today? Should I buy that buttery croissant? You know, all the things. And the news, you know, which I am reading even while I'm up here, you know, the news, Texas, holy moly. And so a division, I do make a division between those two kinds of awarenesses. And I do make a division between the states that are okay with me and the states that are not so okay with me. Yeah? Paddling in Vogler's Cove, completely okay with me. You know, the state of just paddling. You know, worrying about, can I do this? You know, Am I meeting anybody's needs? Can I articulate anything? Is this helping anybody? Those worries, those are not as easy as paddling in Vogler's Cove. And so I make a division, don't I? Like, oh yeah, good thoughts, not so good thoughts. And so those two kinds of divisions, which are really related to each other, but not exactly the same. Can you feel the difference? There's a kind of division I'm making between immersion in measureless space, unmeasured space, and immersion in the particulars. And then there's the division between the states that are okay with me and the states that are not okay. But in both cases, I am making a division. So we have Vimalakirti's sutra saying an undivided mind is the pure land. So when I think about it, you know, I notice I'm not alone in this dilemma. And in fact, the earliest Zen teachings are also about this, about the kinds of divisions I was just finding in myself. So to walk through those a little bit, just in like capsules summary, the Heart Sutra, which talks a lot about emptiness. And I also love Red Pine's latest definition of emptiness, which is that whatever we think of as real is just our imagination. So it's not that it's not real, it's that the way we think of it is not referring to reality. It's what we're imagining. And so what the Heart Sutra offers finally, after walking through this and explaining how it's so, how the way we think of things with all of the divisions doesn't actually correspond to the way things are, which isn't to say not real, right? But to say not an accurate representation. So the Heart Sutra ends up giving us a suggestion, which is recite this, go beyond, go beyond, go far beyond. And so I want to invite us to bring that into our meditations now and at other times. What is it like if you sit with go beyond? What's that? It's not make your mind shut up, you doofus, you know. It's not try harder. It's not even try less. Just go beyond. What's that like? And then we have the Diamond Sutra, which doesn't talk about emptiness, but it begins, as you've heard me say ad nauseum, because I think it's so important. The Diamond Sutra begins by saying, just make the vow, you know, and I usually... the translation, which is, I think, also Red Pine's translation of the words that the Buddha uses in that sutra are, just give birth to this thought at any moment. Just give birth to this thought, which is your vow. Give birth to your vow to say, to liberate all beings, but without... we're staying loose with the concepts, without getting stuck in the concepts of the I, the other, the liberating or the being liberated, right? Without believing, you know, which is a kind of, to believe is a kind of grabbing hold of, actually, you could say. So to give birth to that vow without getting stuck in the concepts is not unlike what the Heart Sutra is offering us, right? It's just using a different, coming from a different angle. So then we have in the Vimalakirti Sutra, which most of you, I think, are familiar with, so I'm not going to dwell there, but that quote, an undivided mind is the pure land, and that really is the theme, right, of the Vimalakirti Sutra. And not taking a position for or against, you know, finding the way to to cooperate with the ongoing process of change, as I Ching says. And then we have the Lankavatara Sutra, which is the one that Bodhidharma recommended, our first ancestor in Zen. And the Lankavatara gives this long and necessarily obscure description of how to come to the place where you can realize that it's okay to let go of your projections, that you can do it, that just about everything that you hold on to is a projection onto what's happening, and you can actually release that again and again, lighter and lighter. So can you see how in these sutras there is a flow that is holding to this central idea of undivided mind? And undivided mind in a field of generosity, in a field of love. So then along comes Bodhidharma, who Red Pine says made as much of an impression as a frog jumping into the ocean. at the time, he had one disciple, right? And we know that fellow, one successor. And then Fuego had one successor, who wrote the verse trusting the mind, which is about non-duality. So the field, so continue, and you know, Bodhidharma was the one who just told everybody, read the Lankavatara, study the Lankavatara Sutra. So that let your mind trust the mind is interesting because it's not trust this part of your mind and get rid of the rest. Trust your mind once you get it well trained. You know, it just trusts the mind. And but he had only one successor. So finally you get the fourth ancestor who had 500. And you know why he had 500? Because he finally came down out of the mountains to where there was fertile land that you could farm and said, let's make a co-op. Let's make a monastery. Let's grow food. We could stay here together and practice together. And that idea was so powerful, right? So he had 500 successors. And the fifth ancestor, who was his Dharma heir, had 1,000. And then came Huineng, the sixth, the jungle dog, who had over 3,000. So this model of settling and making a monastery, making a center, was that powerful. And then Huineng was the one then who wrote the Platform Sutra and talked about one practice samadhi. And a quote from that Platform Sutra is the one that says, the way flows freely when the mind doesn't dwell on anything. That's the one practice. The way flows freely when the mind doesn't dwell on anything. What does that feel like as you hear those words? So, Huineng was visited by Yongjia, who stayed just one night, and then went and went. Oh, yep, I got it. I got it without being a monk, and I've confirmed that I got it. I'm going to go back home and take care of my sister, which is what he did for the rest of his life, and then she edited his Song of Enlightenment, which we recite sometimes. And in under 100 years, there were a dozen monasteries in that area, north of them. And his Dharma heir, Huairang, was the teacher of Great Master Ma, who's the one I'll be talking about on Wednesday, who was the teacher of Baizhang, who was the teacher of Huangbo, and so the lineage goes on. And these are the names that you'll recognize from so many of the koans in our collections. These who dedicated their lives to direct transmission outside the scriptures, not meaning that you don't mess with the scriptures, but meaning that you don't hang on to them. Meaning that this inquiry that we do together is where the power is. So much so that the way really flowered when people started living together and doing this stuff together. It was that powerful. So I think I'd like to stop here. I just wanted to give you that context, that sense of the flow of Zen through those early times, on which our practice relies so heavily, on what they wanted to, the experiences that they wanted to provide were powerful enough for us. In this time when our minds are challenged and when we're wondering not only what is peace of mind, but what is power of mind, right? How in me do I nurture the power to be of use in this time? So bringing into the meditation whatever you bring from this piece of conversation, but also those two quotes, unmeasured space is the Lord's habitation, and an undivided mind is the pure land. And actually, I think I would put that third one in there. The way flows freely when the mind doesn't dwell on anything. And if we take that as an observation rather than an imperative, it's not about making your mind do something. So I'm going to start us 15 minutes of meditation, and I'm not going to interrupt the meditation. I'm not going to speak into it. So get yourself comfy, and we'll just sit for 15 minutes. Now, what I'd like to do is to follow the thread through a few of the cons that we've been bringing in, and then drop back into the meditation a little bit and then have conversation. We have the luxury, because this is a little bit long, of having room for all this. Unmeasured space, an undivided mind, the way flowing freely when the mind doesn't dwell on anything. These questions about what sometimes the thought will come up to me, you know, can we spare the time and the energy and the focus? Can we allow ourselves really to ask these questions about what am I? What is this? What's the nature of this? When there's so much that feels so pressing, and what our ancestors in the way have said all along is, if we want to be like that one who asked, where, you know, if you're so preoccupied with this stuff, where will you meet today? And there's this sense that if I wish really to meet today fully as the expression of life that I am right now in this moment, what better use of my time could there possibly be than to take time to shed the accumulated divisions, the accumulated barriers to being here, and to do that by allowing myself the real, essential, deep questions. What is this? What is it to be me in this time? What is it like? And because, and when can I allow myself to be undivided? Can I allow myself unmeasured space? And it becomes, I start to realize it's not only I can, but I must, you know, it's essential. And it's my birthright. We're born with it, with the ability to be undivided. So Bodhidharma, coming from India, meets Emperor Wu, and in their conversation, the emperor asks, "Who are you, standing here before me?" And if we take that as the most honest question, who are you? Who is this? Then when Bodhidharma answers, "I don't know," then in a way, the emperor's efforts until then to connect by saying, "Oh, here's what I've been doing to spread the word, and please give me the essential teachings of Buddhism," the ways that he has tried to meet Bodhidharma just fall away. As Bodhidharma says, "I don't know." And there's a kind of stop action there. And what occurred to me is that that stop action, which could feel like a challenge, you know, or even a threat, Bodhidharma asks, do you understand? Emperor Wu says, no. He's been stopped in his tracks, hasn't he? And Bodhidharma leaves. So the thread of the conversation is where? Where? Well, it's in unmeasured space. And so we can see that we can see that stop in two ways. We can just see it as barrier, or we can see it as portal. You know, there's no place to go here except unmeasured space. And we don't know whether the emperor goes there. I have a pretty strong suspicion that he does, because then he asks Duke Ji, his advisor, who's quite a shaman of his own, who was that, right? Who was that? And Duke Ji says, that's the great liberator, the bodhisattva of compassion, come to help you. So if that's liberation, in a way, it's liberation by being invited to step off the edge. How about us? So then Bodhidharma goes and sits in a cave. And it sounds, you know, all of this is at least a good part legend, but later accounts say that he was meeting with people and challenging them just by the realness of his inquiry in ways that were so uncomfortable to them that they tried to poison him because they thought he was betraying the teachings, because he was working outside the scriptural common understanding of things. But Huega comes to him in desperation. My mind is not at peace. Please put it to rest for me, Master. And Bodhidharma says, bring me your mind and I will put it to rest. And so one way of experiencing that, bring me your mind, is again as an invitation to step into unmeasured space. Just go look, right? There's this kind of whoo, open the door and out you go, you know. go look. And what about us, you know? We get to do that. That's the invitation to us. What is your mind? Where is your mind? Can you find it? Can you bring it? What about that? Because we're always talking about my mind this and my mind that. I want to clear my mind. I find my mind is too full. My mind is anxious. You know, I'm losing my mind. You know, all the things that we say about our minds, you know. Do you know that Mose Allison song? There's a Mose Allison song that begins, if you would be so kind as to help me find my mind, I want to thank you in advance. Know this before you start, my mind's been torn apart. I lost my mind in a wild romance. So the problem shows up everywhere, right? My mind, find my mind, go find it. And so Huega comes back saying, I've looked everywhere, I can't find it. Unmeasured space. And so in the intimacy of that moment, just as intimate as that moment where Bodhidharma in a way tells the emperor, I can't find me, you know. Who am I? Huh, can't find such a being, you know. I don't know. Where? I don't know, you know. He passes that to Huega as this gift of liberation, yeah? He says, there, I've done it for you, for you. Direct transmission. Here. And really, Andrew was pointing out, really, Huega has done it, you know. Bodhidharma says, go look, right? He leaves the doing up to Huega himself, which is the gift, right? He's not going to tell him. He says, go look, see what you find out. Yeah, and we get to do that. And so then, generations later, as I was saying earlier, you know, fast forward to Huineng, at a time when now there is an established monastery. There's an established, you know, he's put to work threshing rice because they're growing food and providing for a whole community. So Huineng actually walks into this full community where there's conversation going on, people writing on the wall, you know. And there was a lot written on the wall, I think. Tenny, you may remember, but I think that was a hallway in which I think they had like the Lankavatara Sutra or something written on the wall.
Yeah, they were, in the legend, they'd brought painters in to paint scenes from the Lanka. And then when Shenshu puts his poem up there, Hungren sends the painters away and says, oh, we don't need any stinking pictures after all.
That's great. So, because this is special transmission outside the scriptures, you know. So that's great. Yeah. So here they are in the hall, in Lankavatara Hall. And Huineng sees what's written on the wall and goes, ah, wait a minute. Actually, this mirror has no stand. And I love that in our common parlance, we say to take a stand. So isn't that kind of lovely? The mirror has no stand. It doesn't stand any place. It doesn't stand for anything. The mirror has no stand. So if we play with the mirror in a way as unmeasured space, the mirror as the action of mirroring, of, because in unmeasured space, nothing is tampered with. Everything is just as it is, which is a kind of mirroring, right? A mirror which just simply reflects what is, and you get to see it. Then what about that? There is a mirror gives you an image that's undivided. It doesn't come in packages. The mirror has no stand, no place for dust to land. So then, you know, he on the advice, good advice of his teacher, he gets out of Dodge very quickly, and Ming, the head monk, follows him, thinking his old master has lost it, you know, lost his marbles, and you know, it's like, you know, when your mother has changed her will, you know, to leave everything to the gardener, you know. And it's like, oh shit, he blew it. We better go get the robe and bowl back. And so catches up with Huineng, who says, yeah, there it is. We shouldn't fight over that. It's yours. Take it. And at that moment, when Ming finds he can't pick it up, there's your stop, right? There's that stop again. Everything stops. And you could see it as a barrier, but you can also see it as how he's teetering on the edge of unmeasured space. And then into that moment, Huainan, with his own compassion, because he sees the suffering of his buddy from the temple, offers a question. He says, quickly, quickly, before, right? And going all the way back to where I started at the beginning of this talk, that Prajnaparamita, the core practice, before you learn to divide the indivisible, before anything. So, you know, once your parents are born, you know who you are, right? You got your aunts, you got your grandparents, and you got your parents, and you got, and we can look back as far as we can look, unless it's all lost, and we can say, oh yeah, that's where I come from. You know, we've divided the indivisible, because really you've come from, you know, stars. There's no, you've come from and you are everything. So that's indivisible, right? So he says, and poor Ming is trying to figure out who he is. Where are we here? What's the right thing to do? You know, I can't lift this up. What? That doesn't compute. And so Huineng says, quick, before anything, what is the face of Ming, the head monk, calling him by name? So it's not that there isn't a face, right? But what is the face of you? And the way flows freely when the mind doesn't dwell on anything. When in later writes, when he's writing about vows and refuge. And he says this other really beautiful thing in his Platform Sutra, which I was trying to remember on Wednesday, and I opened the book and there it was. Don't you love it when that happens? Like you open up and it's like, oh, it was right here. Good friends, what does repentance mean? Repentance means to be aware of past mistakes and not to commit them for the rest of your life. Unless your mind is forever free of evil, reciting this before Buddhas won't help. In this Dharma teaching of mine, repentance means to stop once and for all. And he says that that is the formless precept. So he says, as for I vow to end all afflictions, no matter how countless, right? Which is we used to say greed, hatred, and ignorance rise endlessly. I vow to put them down. Now we say, I vow to set endless heartache to rest, right? Ending all afflictions, no matter how countless. This means to get rid of the delusions of your own mind. And we could say the divisions, because the fundamental delusion is the divisions, right? So his recitation is really humbling, I think. He says, here I'm going to recite to you the formless repentances. May past, present, and future thoughts, may thought after thought not be corrupted by delusion. May bad deeds of the past be gone. May they be gone from my nature. Such is my repentance. and it goes on from there. But what really struck me about that is you can take it as a kind of judging, a right and wrong kind of statement, or a kind of purification, you know, may I make myself totally pure? But that's not where he's going with it. But where I think he is going with it is, right now, I'm completely free. There's no barrier. This is unmeasured space. And in that unmeasured space, my delusions are not present. They're not real. And so I am free to start over. Always. And I just find that every time I encounter that, I find it really moving. So I think I'll stop there. That was rather a lot. And we still have a nice chunk of time. So let's just take 5 minutes into which I will just drop in those. I probably don't need to. Just that. Just those questions which, you know, the question the Bodhidharma uses to free, or the response, the sort of honest response of Bodhidharma with Emperor Wu, and his question really, do you understand? That's the question he asks. And then with Wega saying, there, I have put it to rest for you, which in a way is an answer that's a question also. And then Huanang saying, quick, right now, before anything, what is your face? They all have this generosity in them of being completely present to the other and really embodying what that Diamond Sutra teaches, right? To liberate the underlying before anything is the desire to free everyone, the desire that everyone should be free. That everyone should be in that pure land of unmeasured space. And so the willingness to just meet, face to face and see what happens without any attachment to result, right? Without any ideas about what will be effective, but just to meet that way. So we're, the offering they're making to us is to be present in that meeting so that it's my meeting, you know, so that Bodhidharma is asking me, do you understand? Or asking me to go, look for your mind. Bring it here. All right, that's enough ranting. Let's sit for a little bit.